It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to. Wow, well, lots to talk about. I gotta look at the crazy GOP cult that, you know, look. First, Rudy Giuliani. Evidently got his research from Facebook, or was it Instagram? No, it was Facebook. No, wait, maybe it was Twitter. No. Maybe it was Facebook. Oh, it was some social media platform, because that's exactly the place that you want the president's personal attorney to get his information. You want Bubba and Lugnut having direct access to the Oval Office. I'm literally, it's one of those things you go, how crazy can it get? Now look, I understand Rudy's all upset. He got banned from Fox. He's getting sued. He's going broke. Trump's not giving him any help. No cover. There's no funding stream. There's no think tank. There's no shill group out there sending out emails saying, poor Rudy, give him a hand. Nothing. He's on his own. No, on his own. And you really kind of have to wonder, at what point does he realize that he's been played the fool? This was America's mayor. And here he is, part of the holy moly, you got screwed trinity. More like the dim light bulb trio, but still. You got him, you got that Sidney Powell, you got the MyPillow guy, who, I got to tell you, I think none of them were read in that this whole thing with the voter fraud, you know, all this stuff was all just a lie. I don't think they got the memo, and I think on purpose. I think everyone else knew what the game really was. I think everybody else knew what the gig was. It was about a coup. It was about setting aside the election that, you know, at every turn they found was well run. Look, I want to find problems. They weren't there. And what did Rudy take into court? Nothing. So you got Rudy. You got the MyPillow guy who's going to get broke. And you got this Sidney Powell, who evidently is already broke, being sued by Dominion Voting Systems for like $1.3 billion each. I mean, Rudy's going to have to get his tin cup and hit the street corner pretty soon. Sidney Powell, on the other side, she has countersued Dominion Voting Systems because she claims that, how did it go? It was really great, that they are suing her and the other two of the nitwit trio. They're suing them to divert attention. This is all a ploy. It's to divert attention from the failings of their voting equipment, trying to change the narrative. And because, look, these three, the three moronateers, they have, according to her, expose serious flaws. But here's the thing. They brought nothing into court. This is the part that gets me. When you got Rudy going, must have been Facebook, or was it Instagram? No, maybe it was Twitter. Of where you get your stuff, you kind of go, I don't know. Maybe if you're a respected attorney, you should probably not. Anyway, she's suing Dominion for $10 million. And I'm going, really? Just $10 million? They're hitting you for $1.3 billion, and you're going to go, I want $10 million. Just plain lunacy. And here's the thing, and this is what gets me. It's all fun when you're talking about these three characters, because really they're just, you know, they're funny. I mean, there's a level of Keystone Coppery, if you will. The bumbling idiots tripping over each other, just... There's a level of just, you know, ridiculous stupidity. And the thing is if it were just these handful, just these couple of kooks, it would be fun. It would be funny. It would be, it would be like, you remember David Letterman's stupid human tricks? It would be like not such a great show of stupid human tricks, but at least you could justify they're just stupid humans playing stupid games, winning stupid prizes. But this is turning into not just Rudy Giuliani, who was America's mayor, was the head of the Republican Party for a while in New York and was looked up to. But it's the entire Republican Party that has lost their ever-loving freaking minds. And it all comes back to this Trump cult. It all comes back to this fear of this rabid base that the Republicans have. Understand, they've been building this for 40 years. They've been building to this point of white rage and building to this point of angering a working class that they've been screwing with bad policies for decades. They've been building this. I mean, I go back to Pat Buchanan back in 92 when I and a lot of other people joked that his speeches were better in the original German. Because he was way out on the fringe. And it was, we were saying back then, look, this is who they're courting. The white supremacists, the maniac crowd, the lunatic fringe, the militia types. This is who they want. These are their peeps. And now you've got the entire Republican Party, basically by the short hairs of these extremists. And whether you have a political system right now who are just afraid of the base, because I hear people say this all the time. Well, you know, when Republican politicians talk in the cloakroom, they say a lot of different things. They're just afraid of being primaried by someone even more extreme, which is not untrue. But I got to tell you, by being silent, by saying nothing, you're just as bad. Now you get this, look what they did to Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, and look what they did to the guy, the Gonzalez guy out in Ohio, where he just said, I've had enough of this. I'm out of here. It takes some courage to stand up in the face of a coup attempt. Now the coup party in full cult mode today. And I happen to spend a little time in front of the TV that I normally don't. But I watched the House hearing with the three generals who Austin, Milley, and the other guy, McKenzie, I think his name is, if I can remember his name right. And I watched in this moment I think Liz Cheney put it best when she said, she apologized for the despicable questioning that came from her party. Because all they were concerned about was attacking Joe Biden. They like a dog with a bone. No real critical thinking, no real thought process. And here's the thing, and this is where I know we as a society are screwed. You get when the political hacks are going at each other. But we're really not a serious people. You really cannot look at what happened in Afghanistan and go, all Joe Biden's fault, and run away. I mean, we cannot look at any problem that faces this country anymore in any critical thinking way, in any rational, lucid, thoughtful way. And, the thing is we're kind of living in this bizarre world of, you ever see the movie Idiocracy? We're living that, only less funny. And it wasn't all that funny. You go down the list of the problems that we have, and we can't solve anything. The thing that we can be is pitted against each other. And I say this all the time. The wealth class of this country is thrilled that we're marginally educated, but hyper self-confident in our positionings. And we buy into the most bizarre conspiracies that are floating around out there. So I happened to catch the hearing, like I said, and all of these House members, they've got their their pre-planned statements that they read poorly because you know a staffer wrote it for them. And they're just looking for their moment to get, oh, I can get on cable news. Maybe Fox News will call. Oh, boy. If I could just deliver the line. If I could just point the finger. General Milley, you should resign. Maybe Fox will call. Who knows? And that's what it really was. It wasn't about, hey, what did happen there? What was wrong? Lessons should we learn? For me, the lesson was don't get involved in a 20-year war. That's lesson number one. Lesson number two is militaries don't nation build. They blow things up and kill people. You know, my friend Rich Ojeda comes on all the time and says, look, we never lost a battle, but somehow they claim we lost the war. That has everything to do with political leaders grandstanding. We should have been out of there years ago. Bin Laden dead, time to come home. But even in this moment, and it was weird to me because the Democrats were actually trying to find some solutions. And I'm not giving them a pass because some of them were trying to just defend Joe Biden as well. Because look, there were some mistakes made. Clearly, you make a choice, you got to go with it. The generals said we should leave troops there. Biden said no. Did he forget? Did he misspeak? Did he just not want to say? I don't know. But at the end of the day, the decision was made. He's taken responsibility for it. But the Republicans, like a dog with a chew toy, they feel the need to just keep chewing without any critical thought into this, without thinking about what happened during the George W. Bush years. We're going to go back and talk about that? Of course not, because that's their party. We're going to talk about the Obama years? They would be thrilled at that. But that doesn't help their immediate need to attack Joe Biden. They're certainly not going to talk about the last guy who created all of this. And he was never getting people out of there. This was a slapdash, let's throw something together so I can look like I'm bringing people home. I'll tell you, I cannot imagine what an evacuation would have looked like under the former guy. And I'll tell you, I'm glad he lost. And Joe Biden was the president because we got out of there in an incredible way. The amount of people that got out in the short period of time that it happened was nothing short of remarkable. And yes, sadly, some people died, but not nearly as many as I would have expected. And look, I'm not a military person, but if you're running out the door while someone's trying to kill you, it's pretty remarkable. Now, we're in this spot where now that the divide comes, should we have left 2,500 troops? I'm of the mindset, no. And as the general said, had we left 2,500 troops, that number was dependent on the Afghan government not failing and the Afghan army actually standing up. Had they collapsed like they did, that number would have been double, would have been 5,000. And I would argue probably even more. Because then you would have, well, ISIS-K, Al-Qaeda, and the Taliban all having, well, a common target. Because we would have broken our word. And this is where I agree with Biden. The choice was not whether we stay or not stay. The choice was whether we get out, bring everybody home, or we escalate. That's the choice. And whether we're there another 20 years. And I agree with his thinking. Get out. Because I don't think in this country we're ready for another 20 years. But yet I listen to those Republicans in the House today, who again, they had their well-rehearsed sound bites. They had their tweet talk ready. They were framing their social media. They were getting it all lined up because, oh, we're going to get on Fox tonight. Oh, boy. But none of them even began to ask questions on what did we learn? How do we make sure this doesn't happen again? And the number of declarative statements that they can't prove, and I understand, and this is where understand what happens in these hearings. You can lie as a congressman. You can make things up. You can say anything and not be held accountable. Now, you're on the other side of the desk, under oath, you have to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help you everything. Or they will come down on you with hellfire and thunderbolts. So you hear all these congressmen and congresswomen going, well, we know Al-Qaeda's crossing the border, the southern border, and they're going to attack us any day now. I just wish they would take some of the energy, some of the fervor, some of the idiocy, tone that down a little bit, and think about how do we move the country forward. But the sad reality is we're not a country that wants to get things done, evidently. We're not a serious country. Hell, we can't even get people to stop throwing temper tantrums over wearing a mask in public. We've got a bunch of children running around. And they start with the people who we are calling our leaders. This is the part that's most frustrating to me. Because these are our representatives. These are the people that we've said, yep, that's the guy I want, the woman I want, that's the person I want to step up and speak up for me. And what I saw today was just disgraceful. And the thing is this is just another day. It was, hey, just Wednesday. This is what happens in Congress every day. And people wonder why people are turned away from politics. When this is where they spend the energy, instead of going, how do we make people's lives better? How do we get that infrastructure bill moving forward? How do we get make sure that granny gets some new chompers and there's some new glasses? How do we make sure that people's lives get better? I didn't hear any of that today. What I heard was, I'm going to score my cheap point. I'm going to get my viral tweet. I'm going to be able to put something on Instagram that'll make the staffers happy. But really nothing about how we move the country forward. And that's sad because there was an opportunity to have a conversation about what went wrong in Afghanistan and to actually learn a lesson on maybe how do we stay the hell out of situations like that in the future. Just my thought. Love to hear yours. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Gonna take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. There's nothing more American than workers standing up.
Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1929. That was the day a mistrial was declared in the case of 16 textile mill unionists in North Carolina. The mistrial sparked 5 days of anti-union vigilante violence. Textile mill workers at Gastonia's Lorry Mill had been on strike since April 1st. They demanded higher wages and shorter work hours, union recognition, and an end to the hated stretch-out system. Soon, textile workers at Bessemer City's American Mill walked off the job in solidarity and joined the National Textile Workers Union. Ella Mae Wiggins was one of the strike leaders at American Mill. She was known for her militancy, but also for organizing black workers into the union. As the strike wore on, mill owners evicted dozens of families from company housing. Wiggins helped set up a tent city. On June 7th, sheriff's deputies attacked strikers who marched to Lorry Mill to call out remaining workers. The police arrived at the tent colony later that evening to disarm them, and Gastonia's police chief wound up dead. Immediately, more than 70 textile union members and leaders were rounded up and arrested. 16 stood trial for the murder of Chief Adderholt. The anti-union committee of 100 smashed up the NTWU headquarters in Gastonia and Bessemer City. They kidnapped, beat, and threatened to kill several union members. The rampage continued as SCAB forces moved on to Charlotte to raid the offices of the International Labor Defense, who had handled the strikers' case. 5 days into the terror, Wiggins was killed on her way to a union solidarity rally. Outrage over her murder forced mill owners to improve conditions and wages, but the fight to organize would continue for years.
For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So good news today. Evidently, LeBron James has wrapped up his research and has gotten vaccinated. So that, I think, is going to be a good thing. I don't quite know what research LeBron was doing. Not sure. I would love to see the reading list that came along with that research. But I'm going to give him credit for coming out and saying, look, we got to do it. I kind of think it was the money. Just kind of throwing that out there. Just a thought. But if that's the research that gets you there, evidently that's what's going to get us there. And if you look across the NBA, like 90% of the NBA is vaccinated. But the story is Kyrie Irving or some other person. When 90% of the people are vaccinated, somehow the message is, well, these few stragglers, these few outliners. Like we talked about yesterday, you got the healthcare system in North Carolina, 175 fired in the largest mass firing ever. You read the story, it was out of 35,000 employees, which meant like 99% of them had already been vaccinated. It's crazy where we are. And here to share some thoughts on just how crazy this is and maybe how we get the push to get us over the hurdle, I've asked Jill Rosenthal to come talk with us. Jill is the Director of Public Health at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, their website. Jill, thanks for taking some time for us.
Absolutely. Happy to be here, Rick.
So let's start with LeBron James. I think it's a good thing. I think finally, about time, should have happened a little bit sooner, I was hoping for. But he's a powerful guy, got a lot of followers, especially in the African-American community. I think this is a good thing.
Absolutely. I would agree with you 100%. I think, you know, if nothing else, it shows that people need to get there when they're ready. And people get vaccinated for different reasons. And I don't know what research he did, but you know, we hear that speaking to people that you trust is something that helps people get there. We've had lots of conversations about the kinds of information people need to feel comfortable if they see others in their community, and it worked for him and it got him where we're glad he's there. So yeah, we can be happy for that.
No, and look, he's a guy who clearly has access to the you know, the best medical care, the best medical advice, the best resources possible. And the message hopefully that comes out of that is, you know, LeBron did his due diligence. Maybe others fall along. Because I had this interesting conversation today, you know, in talking about LeBron. And there were people who were going, well, you know, why aren't black men getting vaccinated at the same rates as everyone else? Because evidently the numbers are really low. And I could only think that it has something to do with how badly broken our healthcare system is. And that a lot of people don't have access to family doctors or regular healthcare in a provider that they trust.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a number of factors, and you're pointing out some of them are access to the medical system. Some of it has to do with structural barriers, mistrust. I mean, the recent information is actually really interesting on the vaccination rates, and it's showing that the racial disparities have really kind of evened out, and they're not like they were at the beginning. You know, when we saw really big disparities in terms of who was getting COVID, and then we saw that follow up with who was getting vaccinated, those disparities in race are not so big anymore. So I think that we've done a good job of finding ways to encourage people, provide incentives, and make the vaccine accessible and convenient and available to people.
No, that's a good thing. I'm glad to hear that. Because look, if we're going to get past this, we've all got to get past it. We've all got to be in this together and moving together in a somewhat cohesive manner. Now, the president they're in the process of issuing a temporary emergency mandate through OSHA to make sure that all workers are vaccinated, especially healthcare workers. And I pointed out a minute ago that the fact that you had this healthcare system in North Carolina, 35,000 employees, where 175 of them, evidently if they get vaccinated, they can come back to work. They're gone. I had a bunch of other stories kind of along the same lines. And the healthcare folks are where we're going, hey, we need you to be vaccinated more than everybody else because, well, we don't want you to get other people sick. What power does the president have? Does he have the authority to do this? Does the Department of Labor have the ability to do this? I'm curious your thoughts.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, we know that there is no question that having staff in any healthcare setting who are unvaccinated poses threats to patient safety and to fellow staff. So it's a, you know, We don't want unvaccinated workers putting people at risk. It's a public health issue, and certainly healthcare providers need to be at the forefront of that. President Biden does have that authority, and he's used that authority through the conditions of participation in Medicaid and Medicare. So any healthcare facility that is reimbursed by Medicaid or Medicare needs to meet certain conditions to be able to be reimbursed. And so one of these conditions is to ensure that folks that work in those facilities are vaccinated. There have been surprisingly some low rates of hospital and nursing home facility staff who have not been vaccinated, high rates of folks who have not been vaccinated. And so this is another step that the president can take, and it's a tool in the toolbox. And at this point, we know to get out of this situation we're in, we need as many people to be vaccinated as we can get vaccinated. And again, this is another tool that's available, and it's good to see that he's using the tools that he has.
Are we concerned that there will be at some point a mass exodus of people? Because we keep hearing these stories that, well, I'm not going to do it, I'm going to leave. And we hear a lot of people saying that out loud, but the numbers yet haven't borne that out. Are we expecting that?
Well, I think if you look at history, we would say no, that we are not expecting that. That mandates really do motivate people to act like their peers. And in fact, the vaccine mandates are actually quite popular in polls. So we know in the past that mandates have helped achieve high immunization rates for other diseases in schools and healthcare facilities. And even national polls are showing that about a third of unvaccinated respondents are saying that they would get the COVID vaccine if their employer required it of them. And the examples that we're seeing are actually bearing that out. So, you know, in the healthcare system in particular, those that implemented early vaccine mandates have retained over 99% of their workforce. So sure, there's going to be issues, but there's a number of examples that I can share of where we're seeing that it actually does work. And, you know, in fact, the public is in support of mandates, and in some polls are saying that they would consider quitting if their employers didn't mandate the vaccine. So
see, that's the story we don't hear enough of, you know, because, you know, I know a number of workplaces where the handful, the loudest, you know, the loudest ones are getting all the attention. I'm never getting a vaccine. Well, you have a choice. And look, I'm not saying that we should be tying people down and jabbing them in the arm. I'm not saying we should be forcing them to have it. But, you know, with choices come consequences. And the consequence here is, sorry, you can't be around the rest of us.
Exactly. I mean, the consequence is for all of us to be at risk from folks that don't want to be vaccinated. So, you know, again, there's examples across both the public and private sector of where this is working. So Tyson Foods has a mandate. You know, even Fox Corporation has a mandate. They have 90% of employees who have been vaccinated since they put their vaccine requirement in. You know, states are doing it. The state of Washington, the state of New York, and they're seeing the numbers are going up and folks are getting vaccinated. And so I think the evidence is showing that vaccine mandates do work and that they're popular. And I think the other issue is that they are good for the economy, because we know that the most effective way to return safely to full economic activity is by being vaccinated. And so this is one way to get those numbers up.
Yeah. Now we just saw that YouTube is saying that they're going to take down all of the anti-vax information. And I'm not a big censorship fan, but on a certain level, when you're just outright making things up, which is what some of this stuff seems to be, maybe you have to address some of this, because misinformation seems to be one of the things that I get a lot of. You know, I heard this or I heard that, and they're mostly anecdotal, a cousin of a cousin, or, you know, Nicki Minaj, her cousin's friend's balls are huge because of the vaccine, which you go, I don't know where that came from. But we hear these kind of anecdotal stories. Do you think it's a good idea to take those things down? Do you think it's something we have to do?
I absolutely do. The science is there, the research is there, and there's a pretty stringent process that the vaccines go through in order to be approved. And it's been through all the approval processes and, you know, with great results. And I think that we need to make sure that the information that's accurate is getting to folks and that they can make good decisions. And those are barriers. I mean, the biggest divide right now between vaccinated and unvaccinated is political party, which is unfortunate because it really should not be a partisan issue. And, you know, if you look at the states that have implemented mandates, it isn't a partisan issue in terms of some of the states that have made vaccine requirements, and it really shouldn't be.
No,
it should be about public health protection.
No, absolutely. And this is where, you know, this is where I started off today going, you know, we're just not a serious people. We're not capable of critically thinking about situations and setting the politics of last November aside. We're evidently not capable of doing that because protecting yourself has now become a political issue. And look, I don't doubt had the former guy won that the other side would be doing kind of the same kind of craziness. I'm frustrated at this lack of critical thought.
Yeah. And you know, I think this whole focus on kind of individual freedom negates the fact that we live in a society where you need that in order to have a society work. We have to protect each other. And it's not a unique situation. I mean, we do have seatbelt laws. You can point to plenty of other examples of where we, constrain our own behavior to protect others around us. And I mean, even in the world of vaccines, most of us got them as children, and they were required in order to participate in public school. And so this is just another one, but it has just become, you know, much more politicized than I think is healthy or helpful at this point. And again, we know that if we want to get ourselves out of this situation, vaccination is the way to do it.
But here's the thing, and this is where I point the finger at the extreme right of our political system. And the folks who, you know, like the snake oil salesmen of the past, you know, like the people who are out there selling, you know, dietary supplements and beet juice or whatever it is as the next miracle cure. There seems to be a lot of people who are making profit off of this. And you know, the fact that they're pushing these things that haven't been proven to be effective or even, you know, helpful. Again, it's another one of those things that make me go, misinformation is one thing, but the profiteers, the moneyed interests, they're the ones, I think, making it even worse.
Yeah, I would agree. I think we've just gotten to a place where, you know, people don't know what to trust anymore. And I, you know, again, that's why it gets back to, I think, trusted messengers and who can deliver a message to people in a way that they can hear it. And, you know, we hear that often is your personal doctor. Most doctors do support vaccination. And so, you know, finding the way to reach people in a way that they can hear it is still really critical.
Yeah, I haven't met one yet that isn't selling something. And I look at these America's frontline doctors who we just now find out because of the anonymous hackers that they've been making millions off of hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin and all of this stuff. And again, it infuriates me because we know this. We know there are charlatans and hucksters out there who just want to dive into our pocket and don't really care about you, me, or anyone else. But, you know, time and time again, we learn this lesson.
Yeah. And I mean, unfortunately, that's been the world of vaccine politics for a while. And, you know, it's an issue with false information about childhood vaccines that people hear it causes this or that and things that are clearly not true and have been proven not to be true. But for some reason, we go back and back to this place over and over and over. But all you have to do is look around you really to see that or follow the data. The folks that are hospitalized are folks who aren't vaccinated, and the folks who are dying predominantly are people who are not vaccinated.
Yeah, I hope folks will take a look at the piece, mandatory COVID-19 vaccination for healthcare workers as a condition for Medicare and Medicaid participation. It's a long title. We'll get some links out on social media how folks can take a look at the work you're doing there, because I think it's important. I think if anyone should be mandated to get the vaccine, it should be the people who are dealing with sick people. Just kind of throwing that out there as a thought.
Absolutely. They're vulnerable people. And, you know, we're doing our best to protect them. And I think, you know, along with those folks who are healthcare workers or providers, I think the other piece that is big news is just Biden's efforts to have the Occupational Safety and Health Administration put in some requirements around large employers. And so that'll be the next piece that's coming. And I think we'll also, you know, take us to another level of protection, which is important.
Yeah, that's only something I've been calling for since, last March. because look, I mean, you brought up Tyson Food a moment ago, and we know that they had some supervisors who were playing kind of a Deadpool kind of thing with their workers, seeing how many people could get infected and doing some really unsavory things. And I would say, look, that's the reason OSHA is here, to protect people in the workplace. So I'm glad to see that Marty Walsh, the Secretary of Labor, and the President are moving in a direction to protect people. Because look, you shouldn't go to work to die. That's just a way to feed your family.
Absolutely. And there are a number of great examples that are circulating in addition. United Airlines is another one that has nearly all of their US-based workforce vaccinated as a result of their mandate. So again, it is doing the job.
Yeah, this is, again, my take on it from the beginning is if we can't figure it out through the wonders of self-governance, capitalism will, because employers don't want to get sued. They don't want their insurance premiums going up. Insurance companies don't want to pay for stuff. It just seems to me that capitalism will move us in that direction. But Jill, I appreciate you taking some time, sharing some thoughts on this piece that you guys have put out. Thanks so much.
Great. Thanks so much. Nice to talk with you.
You as well. Appreciate the time. Jill Rosenthal, she is the Director of Public Health there at the Center for American Progress. Make sure you check out their website, AmericanProgress.org. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1789. That was the day that the United States Congress officially created the United States Army. Not everyone agreed that the U.S. should have a standing army. 2 years earlier, at the meeting that drafted the U.S. Constitution, James Madison warned against a permanent federal army. He told those at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, quote, "A standing military force with an overgrown executive will not long be safe companions to liberty." Since Madison was a strong proponent of a centralized federal government, his caution about the army was noteworthy. Perhaps these warnings is why it took Congress until the last day of their session to finally approve the measure. In fact, President George Washington had to write Congress not once, but twice to get them to act on the issue. Once it was approved, the first standing army had about 800 members. By comparison, in 2015, the army had just under 500,000 active duty soldiers. To supplement the small army, Congress also made a provision for the president to call up troops from state militias. The stated purpose for such call-ups was, quote, "protecting the inhabitants of the frontiers of the United States from hostile incursions of the Indians." While in federal service, the state militias were supposed to receive, quote, "the same as the pay and substance as the regular army." One time, various state militias were used for the forced removal of the Cherokee people from the southeast on the Trail of Tears in the 1830s. State militias were also deployed to break up labor strikes, such as the case in the Homestead Strike in Pennsylvania in 1892. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I gotta tell you, I love listening to some of my Democrat friends complaining that, these Democratic politicians, they're not doing the thing. They're not moving Biden's agenda. They should all be on the same page. And look, I would love it if they would. The reason, and I always love the Roy Rogers quote, I'm not a member of an organized party, I'm a Democrat. I always love that because you look at what's going on. It's like herding cats. And at the front of the line, you've got Manchin and Sinema. How do you get them to come back? Well, figure out how to feed them a little bit. This will play itself out. We'll see where this takes us. But to think that, we're going to all just fall in the line, not going to happen. Understand, policy is really popular. Should be talking more about policies, less about than Joe Manchin. And here to share some thoughts on how we get these popular policies moved through and maybe do a little bit better with messaging. Kind of a thought. I've asked Annette Shanker Azario to come talk with us. She's the principal and founder of ASO Communications. Annette, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So, like I said, you look at the fact that our Democratic policy is wildly popular. We want, money to help keep kids out of poverty. We want education for kids on the front end. And when they go on to college, granny needs new chompers and some goggles and all that stuff. Popular stuff. How come we can't get it through? How come we can't message this? How is it Mitch McConnell is the Lucy and pulls the football away every time?
Yeah. Well, first, let me just acknowledge, as a big acknowledgement for me, that not everything is a messaging problem. There may, in fact, be members of the Democratic Party in leadership who don't necessarily share our values and our views and want to get it done. But you asked me a messaging question, so let me answer that. First thing that I would say is I often tell my clients, don't take your policies out in public. That is unseemly. Policies are great for insider baseball kinds of conversations, but much like when you are wandering through the grocery store and you see that box of instant brownies and you look at the front of that box, what is there a picture of? A brownie, right? But when you open up the box, there's no brownie in that box. There's a bunch of powder. And on the back, there's a set of steps you need to take. We need to stop selling the recipe and start selling the brownie. And it's funny because in your description, Rick, you sort of predicted what I was going to say. You were selling the recipe. You were selling the brownie and not the recipe. So when we look, for example, at a policy like paid family leave or universal health care or raising the minimum wage, wildly popular things, when we say instead, you're there the first time your newborn smiles, or you're paid enough to put food on the table and you're home in time to eat it, when we sell the outcome of the policy, wildly more popular and perhaps more vital, more likely to increase mobilization. Because again, often our messaging trouble is not that people don't think our ideas are right, it's that they don't think our ideas are possible. And so our opposition isn't the opposition, it's actually cynicism. And so it's about messaging that will mobilize, not garner just agreement, but repetition. No. And that's where we need to be talking about outcomes and not the names of our policies.
I'm you're spot on there. What I always say that Republicans talk in terms of narratives. They tell stories. Democrats seem to want to show you how smart they are and how wonky we can be. And I'm like, no. How are you going to make my life better? How are we going to get things done? How am I going to get that hole patched in front of my house? How am I going to make sure that my kids get an education or health care or any of the things that again, are popular? To me, it's the pitch.
And it's oftentimes when we try to make ourselves what I like to call the reasonable adults in the room. So we say things, for example, like doing universal health care will be cheaper. Well, it turns out when you actually test that kind of message, a message that it will be cheaper, which of course is true, I'm not debating what's true or false here, folks who are persuadable in the sample, folks who are on the fence, who could go either way and aren't quite sure what to think, so non-ideologically cemented folks, that actually reaffirms the opposition's narrative. Because when you tell folks it's going to be cheaper if we do it this way, what you're doing is you are giving into the opposition's frame. You are tacitly acknowledging that the way to make public policy decisions is, will it grow GDP? Will it shrink GDP? Will it be more money? Will it be less money? So you tell people first and foremost, that's how to evaluate this.
Right.
And then you actually raise the suspicions that they're most afraid of. The idea that it's going to be crappy healthcare, that you're going to be waiting forever and ever. The horror stories and lies they've been fed about quote unquote socialized medicine, that there's going to be rationing. Instead, what effective messaging does is it seizes the moral high ground. It says things like life and health shouldn't be for sale. Or no matter what we look like or where we come from, when someone we love is ill or injured, we want them to get the very best care without fearing that we'll go bankrupt for them to do it. So you want to talk just like what you said, in imageable terms. How will this feel walking through my life? Not what is the name of your 67-point plan?
Yeah, no, exactly. On the universal healthcare front, I talk to people who are about my age who are looking towards retirement. I go, you know, had we a universal healthcare system where you didn't have to worry about healthcare, you could go do something with the final years of your life that you want to do. We could actually take on jobs that would be our passion instead of we're stuck in this job for 30 years because we got to have the healthcare. And this is why I've always said employers don't want to get rid of it, because they want to make sure that you're tied to that job to get that healthcare. Because it's always been curious to me why corporate America wants it other than as a controlling tool.
Absolutely, because in point of fact, you know, they have plenty of people who are good at math working for them, and they know that in the long run, and even in the short run, it would save them money, because whatever increases in taxes they would save in premiums, even at the pittance and the sort of ungenerous plans that they actually finance, it's exactly what you say. It's about a lack of freedom. It's about being tethered. And what's ironic about that is that that concept, freedom, which is something that the right wing has co-opted, utilized, and the left has been all too frequently scared to use, actually turns out to be one of the most effective animating values we can have on our side. And it's not at all shocking, right, that marriage equality, when it moved from the right to marry to the freedom to marry, and when it moved away from practical benefits, again, that's the adults in the room, like married filing jointly, hospital visitation, toward emotional arguments like love is love and love makes a family, that we began to gain ground. The same is true with the fight for 15. When we were told to talk about wages through practical terms like we need to raise wages because people will be customers in our stores and we have a consumer-driven economy, people wouldn't repeat that, because no one gets out of bed in the morning thinking, I'm real passionate about the GDP and I can't wait how to grow it. But when we instead saw folks saying, people who work for a living ought to earn a living, and obviously I'm biased because I work on these things, right? So I work on this messaging,
right?
Not objective in evaluating it. But when we switched to a moral high ground argument that wasn't about customers in our stores and making sure that people can afford the basics, but instead asserting the money to pay people comes from their work, why aren't they getting it?
No, that's an excellent point. And I would argue the longer version about the economy and all that stuff, which, look, you know, is a byproduct of higher wages, but it doesn't fit really nicely on a bumper sticker. And sadly, what's happened in our society is our thinking has continually shrunk down to now we need bumper stickers and sloganeering and tweet levels. And now, fortunately, Twitter did increase their number of characters. So maybe we're expanding our thoughts a little bit. But it seems like, you know, we're just social media thinkers, and we're not boiling it down to that emotional level in a more digestible level, in my thoughts.
Yeah, and it is understandable that we want to blame social media and the character limits and so on. And that certainly has a huge role to play in terms of, for example, when we look at attention spans around digital ads and how long people will watch a thing without clicking off of it. it is completely obvious, and you can sort of trace the trajectory of that shortening to the advent of social media, the increase of things like TikTok. But as far as the fact that we think through what people in my profession would call heuristics or simplifying structures, that's just a basic facet of human cognition that predates social media, predates the internet.
Yeah.
And in fact, what we see, and this shocks most people, is that the more higher education that you have, the more adept you are at discounting factual information that doesn't fit your pre-existing frame.
Really?
Yeah. What we like to say is that facts bounce off of frames. I often tell people that a more accurate way of thinking about our brains is, I'll see it when I believe it, not the other way around. This is why people tell us, you know, I don't see racism, it's not happening. I don't see sexism, it's not occurring. Because the instances of those things that happen before your eyes, if you're not taught to categorize it as such, you simply are like, well, that's not an instance of that. That's not an instance of working people being screwed. That's not an instance of corporate malfeasance. Or, you know, that happened once, but that's not a pattern. That's not how things work.
Okay.
And the reason why people with a greater amount of formal education are really good at discounting facts that don't fit their pre-existing frames is because they have more cemented cognitive biases.
Interesting. I would have thought it would be kind of the other way around. The more that you knew, maybe the more you would kind of weigh the differences. So you're saying that, you know, the deeper I'm invested in my education, the more I'm going to be dug in, as opposed to, you know, if I, you know, barely got out of high school biology and now I'm a virologist and I'm not getting the vaccine.
So there's two different phenomena. There is the phenomena of folks whose cognition is very, very closely attached, not to rational thought, but to behavioral, to emotional cues and identity. And that tends to correspond with lower levels of formal education. And that is sort of all of the stuff that we know about that you're describing of tribalism. And a lot of that identity, you know, some people's identity actually as an element of it is refusing to listen to people and outside of that identity group and sort of prejudging people outside of your identity group as being wrong, you know, before they even speak. I'm just talking about the very specific thing of being able to accidentally wander through an airport, you see Fox News, they're blathering some bullshit, and you're like, oh, I know that that's not true, right? And you have sort of a very sophisticated analysis around why that fact that's presented to you is in fact completely biased.
Well, just because it's on Fox News, that's all you need to know. Or at least that's my thought. It sounds like you're right. So are we screwed? I mean, is this where, everyone, the most intelligent and the most dim are dug in? Is there any movement?
Yeah. I mean, my theory of change is that you have, I mean, and this isn't just a theory, this is sort of corroborated through a lot of people's study and evidence. You have a group of people who are ideologically cemented on the left, right? I'm going to say that's me. I'm going to guess that's you. Someone could talk at you all day long. I'm going to guess. And you're never going to believe in abolishing the minimum wage. There is no argument a person's going to make. You're never going to believe in a flat tax, right? No one could say anything to you that's going to get you there. Same with me across lots of issues. Just like there are folks like us on the left who are ideologically not moving, there are people like that on the right. But in terms of issues, now I'm not talking about partisan, I'm not talking about party yet, I'm talking about how we feel about issues, most people actually fall somewhere in the middle. They are what I like to call the good point people. They go like this, good point, but also good point. They are swayed by arguments from either side, and what they hear repeated most frequently becomes the way the world works, common sense, what is true. This is the only way to explain the rapidity with which our culture has shifted in our views about, to take an example I used earlier, marriage equality, right? It wasn't that long ago that it seemed completely and totally inconceivable that we would legalize gay marriage right in this country, and here we are. So what gets repeated most often, I mean, This is both frightening and it is also empowering. Messages that are familiar to people are reported to be more likable, more credible, more moving. So what people hear repeated over and over again actually becomes more true for them because it creates what we like to call cognitive ease. It's like when you hear da 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 and your brain goes da da. When your brain does that for you and you don't have to work, you like that message better. It feels comfortable because it feels familiar. So basically, the name of the game is finding messages that the choir is going to want to sing, that is going to get folks to repeat, repeat, repeat a thing so that the middle hears it. Because the way that we persuade people is actually by having their peer network do it, not by having sort of professional organizations do it.
Interesting. So real quick then, you know, what's the message on this infrastructure bill? Because everybody I know wants this infrastructure bill, especially the bipartisan part of it. But we also want the human infrastructure part of it. What's that messaging that will get us to that place to make us all warm and fuzzy with it?
Yeah. So if you specifically mean infrastructure as opposed to the Build Better,
the Build Back Better plan.
Thank you. Build Back Better. Thank you. So much for me being on top of my messaging, right? So if we're talking about infrastructure, what we see in survey after survey after survey, people don't have feelings about infrastructure, right? Like, you never hugged infrastructure. That's not a word that most people use in their common everyday vocabulary. So first and foremost, we want to make it imageable, make it tangible for people. So the road that you drive on, the bridge that you cross, the bus that your grandmother takes, being able to cross town and get to where you need to go on time. So first of all, using that kind of language. And then again, selling the payoff, not the recipe. So this bill is about where we need to go and how we're going to get there. It's about the roads we drive on and the jobs that we're able to have. It's about bringing clean, renewable, it's about bringing clean energy into our communities, protecting the air that we breathe and the water that we put in our kids' cups. So it's really about bringing it back to sort of, how would these things feel as part of my everyday life?
Yeah. How do you make my life better? And this is where I started off the beginning of the year. It's about getting things done. It's about making people's lives better. It's about moving the country forward. And it's about getting the internet that is actually not costing an arm and a leg, that is still somewhat decent in a rural community. That, to me, that's the big one. But Annette, I appreciate you taking some time for sharing your expertise. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
Thanks for having me.
Good stuff. Annette Shankar Azario. She's the principal and founder of ASO Communications. Make sure you check out their website, asocommunications.com. Going to take a quick break right here. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1931. Canadian coal miners, their wives, and children marched through the streets of Estevan, Saskatchewan. The miners were on strike for union recognition and better pay and working conditions. Safety was a major concern for the 600 men and boys who worked in the mines. Water collected in many work areas. Too often, the mine companies failed to replace rotting timber, so roof cave-ins were frequent. Inadequate ventilation led to high concentrations of carbon dioxide. For braving this dangerous underground work, the miners earned only 25 cents for each ton of coal. The miners had joined the Mine Workers Union of Canada earlier that year. They called a strike in September, but coal mine operators refused to meet their demands. Miners and their families decided to demonstrate in the town of Estevan to gain community support. The mayor banned the demonstration and called upon the Royal Canadian Mounted Police to crush the march. The Mounties met several hundred miners and their families and attempted to block the procession. They opened fire on the unarmed crowd. Three striking miners were killed, and many others were wounded and arrested. Finally, on October 6th, the mine owners finally agreed to an 8-hour workday and a minimum wage of $4 a day. But they refused to recognize the union. It was not until the end of World War II that the United Mine Workers finally won recognition in the Saskatchewan coal fields. The strike remains a controversial event in Esteban. The three miners who were killed have the inscription "Murdered by RCMP" on their headstones. Over the years, locals have alternately erased and restored these inscriptions.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.